Well,
alcoholics are odd.
All of us are unique. Each one is different from the next. And I, like the rest of you, am also unique. And in two respects, I differ from many of you. Not all, but many. One is that it wasn't the effect of booze that I liked so much. It was the taste. I just loved it. And the next thing is, we hear at many, many meetings about exceeding and frightful loss. Loss of family, loss of children, loss of job, loss of prestige, loss of money. None of these happened to me. I lost nothing. My wife, at no time, said she was going to leave me. She may have felt like it, but she didn't ever say it. My children were reasonably pleasant to me. I made more money the last year of my drinking than I ever made before in my whole life. From a medical standpoint, I was given unusual honors. Mine was the skid row of alcoholic success. Any of you low-bottom drunks out there who think it's any tougher to be in San Francisco and Fourth and Howard than it is to be on the skid row of alcoholic success, you're nuts. And I'll be glad to talk to you later about it. And I'm not going to give you a drunkalogue tonight because it fundamentally is no different. I was a reserved, quiet, secretive drinker. Maybe my profession made it that way. But I am going to tell you a little bit about the last day of my drinking. I was very drunk. And I went up the hill to see a friend of mine who was in AA. He had had lots of trouble. And I went up to see this fella, and I don't know exactly why. But I knew he was back home. He'd been on the AA program for 7 months. And I went up to see him. And we talked about AA. I hadn't seen him in 7 months that he'd been on AA. And so he gave me a paper to read. And he asked me about the 12 steps. Now, it so happens that I'm a surgeon, licensed to practice in the state of California. But it also happens that my medical training had two paths. Not only was I trained as a surgeon, which is especially that I practiced, but I was also trained as a psychiatrist, a specialty that I do not practice. I could if I wanted to, but I don't. As someone once said in AA, there's nothing worse than a confused psychiatrist. Well, this fellow asked me about the 12 steps and 12 positions and what I thought about them, and I lectured on at great length with all of the steely psychiatric knowledge that I had. And he gave me this pamphlet, and I took it home, and I had my wife read it to me. And there were about 30 or 35 things to the active drinker. And my wife read them to me. And only two do I recall. One said, do not give up drinking for anybody else except yourself. And this hit me squarely between the eyes. I don't know why, but it did. And the next one was, don't consider yourself a martyr because you stopped drinking. And this hit me squarely between the eyes. And I have absolutely no idea why it did. Because on that particular day, I don't recall being attuned to the idea that I was going to stop drinking. And I was very drunk. Well, I broke down and cried at that minute. And something happened to me which to this day I do not understand. And my wife, a very good-natured bird, and she came up to me and put her arms around me and said, "Well, I'm sure things will be all right." It was about 4 o'clock on a very sunny Sunday afternoon, and we had a little barbecue area up the hill. And she said, "Won't you go up and make some fire?" Well, on a hot Sunday afternoon, I was drinking giant-sized Alexanders. I had a 12-ounce glass, and I'd put in one-third vodka. I drank vodka the last 6 or 7 years of my drinking. The idea was it wasn't supposed to smell your breath. Of course, it reeked out through your pores. You know. One-third vodka, one-third cream of cocoa, and one-third cream. And I walked up the stairs to the barbecue area, and as I got to the top stair, I looked at my glass, and I only had that much left in it. And I decided to turn around to come down to the kitchen to make another drink so I would have it there. And as I turned around on that top stair on this sunny Sunday afternoon, the thought suddenly pierced my innards, "This is the last drink." And it was just as though somebody had reached down and taken a big heavy overcoat off my shoulders and put it on the ground. And I recall the sun got a little brighter on that particular day. And the compulsion and craving to drink disappeared at that instant and has never returned. Well, I carried this little paper in my pocket for a long time. And it wasn't for about 8 or 9 days that I made my first meeting. And I'd like to describe to you that first meeting. It was in the Methodist Church in Mill Valley, which is a suburb of San Francisco. And there was a table, the ordinary banquet table that you see, that was this 8x4. And in this meeting, there were 5 people only. I found out later this group was about to fade, but it didn't. It built up and is now a good-sized group. And at this end of the table was a man named Clark, who was a butcher. And at this end of the table was a man named Shorter, a little sawed-off fella, bald as a billiard ball, who was a carpenter. And on that side of the table was a man named Vern, who was a baker. And on this side of the table was my friend, who was a self-styled inventor, and then I was there. And I looked around at these lowlifers, and I thought, what in God's name am I getting into? And I asked to be excused, and I went outside beneath a great oak tree in front of Wesley Hall at this Methodist church, and I took counsel with myself. And I said, here I am, a physician, a surgeon, licensed to practice in this great state of California. And here I am, a diplomat of one of the great surgical specialty boards in the United States. And here I am, a fellow of the American College of Surgeons and a fellow of the International College of Surgeons and also a member of the American Psychiatric Society. And I've got to go back into that room to have the butcher and the carpenter and the baker and some half-baked inventor make a man out of me. And I went back in. Well, if I lived a million years and I spent 24 hours a day trying to repay these 4 great men what they have done for me, I couldn't break even. Well, about this time, I latched on to one thing. When this organization was getting started in 1935 or so, I, as a physician, went to see a psychoanalyst. And I saw this psychoanalyst for 5.5 years, an hour a day, 5 days a week. to get some help. Now, this was a great thing. This is something that I would do again. But it didn't help my alcoholism. Well, it wasn't too great in those days, but it got in my hair frequently. It progressed later on. But one thing had never occurred to me, and that was the fact that God might be interested in me. Oh, I believed in God and the law of gravity and the law of growth and a few other things, but it made no sense to me, and it had never passed my mind that he might help me. Well, there was a little group in one of the meetings in our town, and they were kind of select. And they read other books and other bits of literature. Well, I got all of this literature. I got all the books by Emmett Fox, and there are 57 of them, and I read every one of them. And I got books that were written by Norman Vincent Peale. And I got books that were written by a variety of people. And I put a Bible in my car, and I put a Bible in my office, on the second desk to write. And I put an office in my locker in the surgery at the hospital. And I put a Bible by my nightstand at the bed. And we used to meet now and again, this group, and we'd say, now have you read such and such on page 35 of such and such a book? No, I haven't read that. And back I would go home and I would read this. And I was devouring all of this business about the spiritual concept of our program. And I was reading a variety of books. And slowly I found myself being elevated. I found a sense of ecstasy. I found that I was elated. And I seemed to rise. I seemed to rise off the ground. And I seemed to get way up here on a cloud, and I felt like hell. And I almost got drunk. Well, I went to a meeting in our area. And there was a great, big, tall Oklahoman who had a fantastic chuckle. And I didn't know what he was talking about. He quoted the Bible and a few other things. But somewhere he made a little bit of an impression on me. And later I went up to him. I found out his name was Chuck. And I said, Chuck, I'd like to ask you a question. I was all set to resign. And I said, Chuck, I'd like to ask you a question. What is this that they call God's will? Well, he looked at me and he laughed at me. I could have poked him in the nose. And he laughed at me and he said, I'll tell you what. I understand you're a physician. Yes, I am. He said, if you were kind to a patient so that patient would send you another patient, that's you talking. But if you were simply kind to a patient, that's God talking. Well, that made little sense to me. And then I went back to my meeting, and I got a hold of the butcher, Clark. And I said, Clark, what's the matter with me? I said, I might just as well be drunk as I am, like as I am now. Well, he said, let me get you a cup of coffee, Earl. And he did, and he took me over to a chair and a couple of donuts. And he's a man of very few words. He said, well, you've been around here now 3 or 4 months, and he said, you haven't gotten drunk, and you've come to meetings, and you're doing all right. I said, Chuck, but I feel terrible. Well, he said, we have an organization in Mill Valley that's known as Alcoholics Anonymous. Why don't you join it? Well, I said, what do you think I've been doing around here for the last 3 or 4 months? He said, well, I don't know what you've been doing, but it doesn't have very much to do with Alcoholics Anonymous. And I said, well, Chuck, what would a person do? He said, I don't know what you should do, but why don't you go home and get a hold of the big book, and why don't you open it to chapter 5 and just read what it has to say. That's what I would do. And so I did. And I went home and I read, rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. They aren't at fault. They seem to have been born this way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living that demands rigorous conscience. Their chances are less than average. The book said there are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders. But many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. It said, our story is disclosed, what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided, it said to me, that you want what we had and are willing to go to any length, it said to me, you're willing to go to any length to get it. If you decided that you will go to any length to get it, then you can take these steps. And on it went about giving oneself thoroughly to this program, being rigorously honest with oneself. Half measures availed us nothing. It didn't say half measures availed us half, or 90% measures availed us 90%, or 10% measures availed us 10%. It said half measures availed us nothing. Well, something happened to me that night as I read that book. Well, I'm not going to give you any more of that history, but it was that chapter, on about the first or second day of my fourth month, which meant something to me. And then, though I don't treat alcoholism, and I'm not interested in treating alcoholism, because the problem was so close to my heart, I have read all of the medical literature about alcoholism. And I want to share with you just briefly what we're trying to say, those of us who are alcoholic physicians, to other doctors about alcoholism. How is it that you and I become powerless over alcohol? Now, as you know, our program is a threefold one. Alcoholism is a threefold disease. It's a spiritual disease, and for the time being, I'm going to set the spiritual aspect over here and not disregard it, but I'm not going to talk about that for a moment, or at all. And then it's an emotional disease, and I'm going to take and set that over here and not talk about the emotional aspect. And then it's a physical disease, and this I'm going to talk about for just a few moments. Now, as all of you know, incidentally, the emotional part of the program of alcoholism is open to therapy by psychiatrists. Now, as you know, the psychiatrists, and God rest their souls, I enumerate myself as a member of their society and am one of them, in a sense. They say, and rightfully so, that if one has a particular problem and one finds out the root of that problem and understands it, that it fades and this problem no longer exists. Now, in alcoholism, if one could find out why it is that one drinks, this would then fade and one could then drink again. Now, this makes perfect sense to me. Absolute sense, except for one thing. It doesn't work. Now, all of us go through periods of tension throughout the day. We get a little tense. We wonder, are we going to go to this meeting tonight? Then we decide, either no, we're not, or yes, we are, and that tension drops off. Now, we go through a multitude of tensions throughout the day. It's kind of basic psychology. Some of them are prolonged. What we're going to do is a lifetime work, and we may linger in this tension for several weeks or months or so on. Now, all people, there are 70 million adult drinkers. Now, as far as I'm concerned, alcohol is the savior of the human race, or one of them, except for you and for me. There are only 4.5 million of us who cannot drink. What happens to the social drinker? He drinks, his tongue loosens up, and he becomes more affable, he gets things off his chest, and he feels better. It says that the inhibitions of mankind are alcohol-soluble. The alcoholic drinks. The non-alcoholic tensions fall off rather gradually. But as the alcoholic drinks, his tensions fall off abruptly. It does something for him. Now, medical science feels, and is beginning to gather data on this, that there is a something that's inside of you and me. We get no credit for this or discredit. It's been called so far the X factor. Now, alcohol doesn't make the alcoholic any more than gasoline makes auto accidents. Oh, yes, you need alcohol in order to become an alcoholic. You need gasoline in order to have an auto accident. But it takes a unique kind of driver. It takes then a unique kind of drinker. You and I have then something different, a physical difference inside of ourselves. Part of this may be psychological, part of it may be sociological, but certainly part of it is physical. Now, as a person takes, a person gets such fantastic relief from booze, one then returns to booze quicker, the alcoholic does. And as one takes a foreign substance into one's body, the tolerance to that substance slowly grows more and more until finally it takes this much alcohol to give the same effect that that much alcohol used to give. I remember years ago operating on a woman who was taking 40 grains of morphine a day. Now, the deadly lethal dose of morphine is a half a grain for a person's rest. That means that she was taking each day enough to kill any 80 of us. What had happened to her? Over the course of years, her tolerance increased so that she needed that much morphine to give her the same relief that this much used to give her. Now, she was taking morphine in the black market. Now, that's usually watered down by 3/4, so let's say she was taking 10 grains of morphine. That's still enough to kill any 20 of us. Now, as the alcoholic then returns, this gives him fantastic relief. The X factor inside is suddenly combined with booze. He then comes back to alcohol quicker and quicker. Now, anyone who exposes himself often enough to a sufficient quantity of alcoholic over a long enough period of time will become an alcoholic. The only thing is that most people don't have the motivation. They don't have the X factor. We do. So we return often enough, and we drink ever-increasing amounts, and over a long enough period of time, and we become alcoholics. Sometimes in a day, sometimes in a year. Usually it takes 15 years of drinking before one steps across that invisible line. Now, if you took the body and you compared it to a bucket like this with a spigot on the bottom, and you poured into this body bucket a half an ounce of whiskey per hour, or 8 ounces of beer per hour, you would not get drunk. Now, if anyone in this audience is stupid enough to go out and test that, you'll find that very shortly, the half ounce that you started with, being alcoholics, will soon be 4, 5, and 6 ounces. Let's say it's 6 ounces per hour. Of that 6 ounces, at least one half ounce will not contribute towards your drunkenness. Now, then a half ounce per hour is of no value to the alcoholic. He must get quantities into his body because his tolerance is ever increasing. He must have, he literally has to have, this is an absolute requirement to him, have that much alcohol in order to get the same effect that he used to get. This then leads to one of the first symptoms of alcoholism, namely gulping. How many of you have gone to a party in your drinking days and seen someone take a martini and lift it lightly to his or her lips and sip it? It just drives you crazy. To make things worse, the person who has sipped this cocktail then takes the martini and has the temerity to sit it down again. Now, this shows that we need to gulp the booze into our body. Now, one of the next symptoms that occurs along this time from a physical standpoint, and bear in mind that always the alcoholic is being cornered by his ever-increasing tolerance on the one hand and utter and complete social disapproval on the other hand. Now, the alcoholic, when he has a little money and he's in his home and he mixes drinks and to take them into the kitchen, he's always around the source of booze. And as he's about to take the tray of drinks into the living room from the kitchen, he pours out 3 ounces into a glass and knocks this off. This is fine, you see, until someone says, "What are you doing that for?" Well, he says, "I don't know. It's seemed like a good idea somehow. But he senses that this isn't approved of. And the next time he mixes this tray of drinks and he pours out his 3-ounce shot, he looks quickly out the room to see if anybody is looking, and then quickly knocks it down and then takes the tray of drinks in. This leads then to the second symptom known as sneaking drinks. And finally he says, these people at this party are drinking too much, and so I'm going to take this bottle and I'm going to pour some into a glass because I'm worried about them, and I'm going to put it up on this shelf behind some dishes so they won't see it. And the next time he buys booze, he buys an extra pint, which he puts in the glove compartment of his car, or he puts it out in the garage or some other place. There used to be a cry, why didn't they make flat fists? Because if you put a round fist in your shirt drawer under the shirt and you quickly open that drawer, the damn thing rattles. But if you had a flat fist, this wouldn't happen. They've now solved it. Now, if you took the following formula, that says 1 molecule of ether, ordinary surgical ether that we use in the hospital, and add to it 1 molecule of water, H2O, you would then have alcohol. So alcohol and ether are identical, except for that minor difference. As the alcoholic's tolerance is ever increasing, he is then taking into his body ever increasing amounts of ether. Obviously, then, he slowly anesthetizes himself and develops blackout. I'm not talking about passing out now, but blacking out, and these you all know. Waking up in strange hotel rooms, waking up in strange cities, in strange beds, and so forth. Now, up to this time, the gulping and the sneaking, the blackout, the alcoholic has developed what we call toxic dependent drinking with very, very shaky control. The next symptom he develops is when he finds out that his boss is coming that night or some other important person. He says to himself, I'll just have 2 drinks tonight. It's important that I don't get drunk. And wakes up the next morning in a blackout, from a blackout. This getting drunk inappropriately when least planned on is the most dangerous symptom of all. And then he wakens in the deepest, the most fantastic, the most gnawing, the blackest feeling of remorse which filled the alcoholic heart, as you know. Now, there is no word that describes the remorse that you and I have felt. Dread, awe, terror, don't even come close. Now that it occurs to the alcoholic as he then develops the shakes and the sweats, and medically we don't know why the shakes and sweats occur. Some say it's because of an imbalance of the adrenal glands, the fluid balance is off, and a variety of things. The enzyme systems of the body are off, something in the midbrain, but at least this is agreed upon by the specialist. At least 1/2 of the shakes and sweats are because we're scared half to death. It then occurs to the alcoholic, why not take a little bit of the hair of the dog that bit you? This then starts the morning drink, and this appeals to 2 things in the alcoholic. One, alcohol is a sedative, it is not a stimulant, and the next thing is it appeals to his ever-increasing tolerance. He needs it. So then, inappropriate drunkenness, remorse, the shakes and sweats, and finally the morning drink become his companion. And then rationalization. Someone comes in and says, hey, aren't you drinking more than you used to? And he says, well, yes, I am, but I'm a big, strong man, and I can stand it. And in a sense, he's right. He's telling a physiological truth. He can tolerate more. Or a woman may say, yes, I'm a small brother, but I'm potent. And she's telling somewhat the truth. And this leads to an endless series of rationalizations. And then the alcoholic, about this time, develops a series of emotional symptoms which are due to alcoholism. They are chemically induced emotional symptoms. They have nothing to do, more or less, with the alcoholic, pre-alcoholic personality. One of them is resentment, the deep, burning hatred of things.
hatreds towards wives, towards bosses, the misery that one feels, the heartless gnawing pit of one's stomach. And then comes the symptom that alcoholics are just fascinated by. They love it. They love to pour it all over them. They reek with it. They hate it, but they're just fascinated by the whole thing. And this is gulps of self-pity. Just love it. I remember drinking at the Martin Hopkins Hotel in my drinking days and sitting alone. And there was a dance floor, not quite this big. And I always sat over in that corner, and there was a series of windows looking over San Francisco. And I would sit at this table, not looking at the dancers or the people at the table, but looking out that window with the inner feeling that people would look at me and say, "Mom, look at that lonesome man. How horrible he must feel. How he must be suffering." I loved it. Just loved it. And then I would get up and I would walk down the aisle between the tables, and I wouldn't look at anyone at the table. I'd look simply over their heads as I carried a half-full glass and slowly walked down that aisle and out of the Peacock Court of the Mark Hopkins Hotel. And then going and sitting on a bar stool, the alcoholic develops a series of feelings about himself. As he sits on the bar stool, he looks to his right and he notices a man to his right, and he's certain that this man is simply a beginning plumber. And he looks to his left, and he's certain that this man is simply a beginning carpenter. But believe me, Einstein sits in the middle. This is the way he gets to feel. And the alcoholic often will say to himself, "I have heard that there's a second coming of Christ, and I wonder. I wonder." These fantastic feelings occur as one tolerance to booze increases and he needs more and more over the course of time. I'm not going to belabor these symptoms except to say one thing. If you took alcohol, that says if you took a molecule of alcohol and you added to it two molecules of carbon dioxide, that air that we exhale is carbon dioxide, and you added that two molecules to one molecule of alcohol, you would then have table sugar. So table sugar, alcohol, and ether are absolutely identical except for tiny, tiny differences. Now, if one takes in tremendous quantities of alcohol, one is then not only taking in ether, one is also taking in sugar. This satisfies caloric requirements. The alcoholic is not hungry, but he has no protein, no fat, and no vitamin equivalents, and he gets into malnutrition. Let me take one kind of malnutrition, vitamin B2 deficiency, that is rather marked, a sense of emotional instability, crying easily, a sense of impending doom, a sense of disaster. And you add this to the other alcoholic symptoms, and you can see what a mess this fellow's in. Also, alcohol stimulates the appetite early in the game, and later on it depresses it, so the alcoholic is not hungry for those reasons. And finally, alcohol will make a early drinker sleepy, but as all sedatives do, they finally reverse their action and finally make him wakeful. And so insomnia becomes his constant companion, and he drinks to go to sleep, and he can't go to sleep, he's wider awake, and he drinks to get drunk, and he can't get drunk, and he drinks to sober up, and he can't sober up, and he's suspended between nothing and nothing. Now, at this particular time, the alcoholic may end up in a jail, he may end up in a hospital, he may change cities, he may change jobs, he may change wives, and a variety of things. Then comes the final stage of addiction, where the only thing that's important is alcohol. And he's given up all prestige. He doesn't care what happens to him. He's on skid row. Only 10% of alcoholics are on skid row. 90% of alcoholics are in the home next to you. And finally, he ends up with DTs, Korsakoff syndrome, and death. Alcoholism is an absolute, incurable, always progressive disease unless sobriety intervenes. Let me show one other thing. up there are indicating the various symptoms that I gave you. The A means abnormal symptoms of drinking, N means normal symptoms of drinking. In other words, a person who's on that first line, let's say, has 10% abnormal symptoms, and the rest of his drinking is normal. The second line, the person has 50% abnormal symptoms, and the rest of it, his drinking is 50% normal. The last one is Skid Row, where a person is 90% an abnormal drinker and maybe 5 or 10% a normal drinker. Never does control completely leave. Even the Skid Row alcoholic can stop long enough to bum a dime to buy a quart of Muscat wine. Now, this line here is that invisible line over which you and I have stepped. It's taken us roughly 15 years to get to that line, but one day we overstep that line, and once one has gotten through that line, there is absolutely no turning back, as far as one knows. Now, you say 15 years, I was an alcoholic from the first drink. This is true. Let me tell you a story. I operated a good number of years on a little sweet soul who was not old, but she looked very old, like a sweet piece of Dresden china, snow white hair. And I did a rather large procedure on her, and I gave her a half ounce of brandy to take three times a day to relax arteries. Now, this is a good, respected medical treatment. This woman had never had a drink before in her whole life. She was a very staunch Episcopalian. On the third postoperative day, she was out of bed, stealing the keys from the nurses to get into the liquor cabinet. 3 days. Now, this is fantastic in its quickness, but it does happen. Some people drink for 40 years before they step over that line. The majority drink 15 years. This, then, is normal drinking here. Now, once one gets beyond this large chalk line, the path is always in this direction. And distributed along that line are close to 250,000 drunks in Alcoholics Anonymous, each who has come to his own end point. Maybe it's up high, maybe it's down low, maybe it's three quarters down, maybe it's one third of the way down. But for each one of us, we have come to a point where we have said, this is all I can stand and still maintain myself intact. And so there are then a series of bottoms. There is no bottom that all alcoholics have to come to. It's ridiculous to compare the bottom of one alcoholic to another, each unto his own. And that is the end point for that person. That person has lost as much control as he can stand without busting apart. And so he comes then to this program. Now, what happens to the alcoholic who has developed all of these symptoms? What is there for him? I might go on to say, before I get into that it takes then roughly 15 years to develop all of these symptoms of alcoholism that we know so well. Now, the strange thing is that even though a person is sober for 20 years, should he return to drink in a very short time, a day, a week, maybe even a month or two, all of these symptoms, which originally took 15, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25 years to develop, come on almost instantly. This is why we say we cannot take the first drink. It's like the hay fever sufferer who cannot get around ragweed because if he does, he'll start to sneeze. And did you ever try to tell a hay fever sufferer to get some willpower and to stop sneezing? It's impossible. The same is true of the booze artist. So one drink starts off our allergic response that we originally took 15, 25, 10, 25 years to develop. The hay fever sufferer may have been around ragweed for 30 years before he develops hay fever, but never again can he get around ragweed again without having this whole thing stuck. And so then all of these symptoms that we have, we solve by this. Which is Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, the alcoholic is a strange breed. The alcoholic is exceedingly sensitive. It's my impression that the alcoholic, from his very first day in life, right or wrong as this may be, this is as I see, is so spiritually endowed, it is so much a part of him, that this world makes no sense. And if he goes around his life, if the alcoholic can tell in an instant when someone is being insincere, the alcoholic can tell instantly when someone is laughing too much. The alcoholic can tell in a moment when someone is crying too much. The alcoholic instantly can tell when someone is a bit of a fraud. This is second nature to the alcoholic. Now, in this world where we do not get close to one another, this is a compulsive culture. Insincerity is part of our culture. I'm not criticizing it or condoning it. It's part of it. We say, alcoholic and non-alcoholic alike, very commonly, good morning, without either meaning good or morning. As a matter of fact, we often miss in the afternoon and say good morning when it's afternoon by that time. We have then these phrases that are meaningless. The alcoholic cannot stand it, as far as I'm concerned. It breaks his heart. And he says to himself, apparently, this is the way you're supposed to function in this world. And he says, all right, if this is the way you're supposed to function, I'll beat the whole goddamn bunch of them. And he becomes the master of insincerity. He becomes the master of when to laugh. He becomes the master of when to act sad. And he becomes the master of when to do things that are a little bit off the beam, but which supposedly meet the cultural norm, and it breaks his heart. And he hates the other person who is insincere and who is dishonest, and he can sense them in a minute, and he's doing worse than they are all along the line. Until finally he comes to this organization, and he finds that there's a God, that there's a somethingness that runs this world. And he thinks something like this, finally, as great relief comes to him. As he looks heavenward and he says, boss, apparently this is the way you wanted people to function in this day and age. Apparently you wanted us to be a little fraudulent, a little insincere, and at times laugh too much. Alcoholic and non-alcoholic alike. I don't like this, boss, as he looks heavenward. But he says to himself, apparently this is what you want. I don't know what you're going to want in 1967, but apparently this is the way it is today. And finally, the alcoholic is relieved, slowly, as he stays on this program, of having to change the person around him, because the boss said so. And this is the one thing, this conscious contact with a somethingness is the thing that the alcoholic has to have more than life itself in order to maintain sobriety. And I have to think for just a moment, what is it that you people possess? We owe in tremendous debts of gratitude to the physician. The physician has worked endlessly to give us sobriety, but unsuccessfully so. The physician has not been able to give you and me the kind of sobriety that we have to have. And yet he's worked endlessly. We never can repay the doctor for what he has done for us as alcoholics. And then we think of the clergy, how the clergy have prayed over us and to the side of us and about us and to us and for us, and have literally given their lives, these men of the cloth, so that we can maintain sobriety. But barring a few circumstances, they have not been able to give us the kind of sobriety that we have to have. And the psychiatrist God rest his soul. He's put us on couches, endless series of couches, and he's tried to understand what is it that makes us function as we do. Why do we do as we do? Why do we think as we think? But unfortunately, he has not been able to offer you and me the kind of sobriety that we have to have. And yet you can get together a few arrogant, egotistical, fraudulent drunks and simply talk to one another and give a series of drunk-alongs. And I'll be damned if we don't stay sober in the way that we have to stay sober. Now, what is this thing that you possess that reeks from your eyes as I see you and screams from your heart as I shake hands with you? And if I look at you, I can say, you've got it too, and you've got it too, and you've got it too. What is this thing that you all possess which has meant to me so much? I haven't the remotest idea what this is. I suppose that the physician might call this psychosomatic medicine. I suppose that the psychiatrist might call it benevolent interpersonal relations. Or he might even call it group psychotherapy. And there are those who would call this esprit de corps. But this power, which I feel radiating from you each time that I am with you, and which has meant life and death to me, this curative power that you all have, to me, is the very essence of God. Thank you very much.